This week on the BOAG World Show, we discuss how to design for maximum visibility and how to write compelling calls to action. This week's show is sponsored by Balsamic and Full Story. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of conversion rate optimization, user experience and digital strategy. My name is Paul. I'm dying slowly of various illnesses, BOAG, and joining me is always happy and joyous and annoying at the same time, Marcus Lillington.
I'm not always happy. I just sort of, I was blessed with seeing the glass half full. The arse half full? I don't know what I just said.
The arse half full. You are an arse, but... And yeah, other than you occasionally throwing out your back, you're also this healthy person, which is unfair considering the amount you eat and drink and smoke.
Maybe the two are connected, Paul.
Yeah, perhaps I should be eating and drinking more. Tell my wife
No. And I actually believe this, but I don't... probably don't have any evidence for it at all. If you take a positive view point, or
I see.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or rather, yeah. Rather, stress makes you ill.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm certain of that. Yeah, I think there is evidence to suggest.
Yeah, that sounds like a thing. Let's call it a thing. Yeah, so medical advice from Paul and Marcus.
Yeah. Well, it just makes qualified a change from legal advice, shittle. Doesn't it? Yeah, go and stick a knife in your hand.
That'll help.
If you can not be worried and stressed about things, you're less likely to be physically ill. I'm certain that's a thing.
Yeah, it is a thing.
So that's all it is then. That's it.
There you go.
That's why. I
just need to stop worrying about life.
Yeah, don't worry, Paul. It'll all be fine.
And we've got Andrew Miller in the room who is being rude to me. He says I look like Uncle Fester. I don't even know who that is, but I know he's being rude.
Yes,
who's Uncle Fester?
Yes, you do. The Adams family.
Oh, no! I used to like Andrew. Right, I'm ignoring that channel then.
That's
not happening.
Funny.
So we've got a bit of an erratic recording schedule over the next few weeks because I'm globe-trotting.
Hey, Paul the globe-trotter.
You're
going to be miserable about that as well?
No.
Good.
I'll tell you why I'm not going to be miserable about that, because my wife is coming, which is awesome.
Yeah.
It's so much nicer. It's just unbelievably much nicer. So, yeah, she's coming to New York with me next week when we're going to go to the Smashing Conference. I would say do a plug for the Smashing Conference, but by the time this goes out...
it'll be gone.
It'll be gone.
Yeah.
So it's a bit late.
Well, the next
one. There you go.
Well, some later in the year or next spring or something.
And then I'm going to... am I going to Estonia or the Ukraine? I get them confused. That's so embarrassing.
Over there somewhere.
Am I going to the Ukraine or Estonia? Which is it?
Estonia.
We're going to Estonia. I knew that. I did. I'm a professional.
What's happening in Estonia? Don't you like people don't come back from Estonia? It sounds like
don't tell me that. No, that's not true because I've spoken to Chris, right? Who
Hello,
is a lot
Anselm,
more trustworthy than you.
Yeah, me. What my
right?
Chris out there?
Yeah,
okay.
And he went on. He went to Estonia, the capital of Estonia, and he told me lovely things about it. So I'm very excited.
Okay, just don't stay out after dark. You'll be fine.
Yeah, shut up.
I've got no idea where that came from. No idea.
So you just, you just make stuff up.
Yeah.
What else is going on in life? I'm started fiddling with my home electronics, which is fun.
Yeah, I saw this in the notes and lots of people do this. And I am genuinely interested because I don't know what, I know that you can buy plugs that you can put in the wall or turn your lights on and off via your Amazon Echo or whatever, but what else? Why would it be worth it?
It's not worth it. No,
it's just go so you can talk
it's
to the
boys
wall.
It's boys with toys. My wife rolls her eyes every time I mention it.
Okay.
And it's Yeah. You can get loads of pointless things. So I can turn on my television with my voice, which is good. And I can say, to my Google Home to start playing Netflix and things like that. And what else have I got going on? I can also turn off all my... I'm going to replace the light switches so that I can turn that on. I can adjust the temperature with my Nest that is arriving soon, my Nest thermostat. And I was going to get it to unlock my front door, but that turned into a major farce. It all sounds so easy in theory and then absolutely impossible in practice. But it's those kind of things that you could waste thousands on and hours of your life. So
and actually, it'd be a bit shit in the end of it all anyway.
Yeah, okay. Pretty much.
Although, as Michelle says in the chat room, sometimes she can't move, so smart plugs are useful from that point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you've got a medical condition, yeah, well, that's all well and good.
Why
you
would
can make
you
up all kinds of things.
Connected fridge. Why?
Why do I want a connected fridge?
Internet
so connected that, fridge. So that it will tell me when stuff is going off in the fridge and needs replacing.
You can just look for crying out
loud. You can. But you could just get up and turn off a switch, unless you're Michelle that can. But you see, there is nothing cooler. There is nothing that makes you feel more like you've got superpowers than being able to talk to your robot vacuum cleaner and tell it to start vacuuming the lounge. That is the coolest thing on the planet.
And go with it. I can actually see a use for an internet-enabled oven that you could, like, say, I want this to be cooked in blah, 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 or whatever. Or
Yeah.
I just couldn't.
Or a microwave. That. Because microwaves are impossible to program, so it'd be much nicer just to be able to say, I've put this in it, cook it, please.
I'm still not... there are things I love more than to have a, I don't know, James Bond-style home.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is a total waste of time. But there are some nice... It's quite nice. You know, the thing that got me into it was we ended up with, you know, so many mood lights around the house. Do you know what I mean? Not main lights, but and I got sick of going around every night turning them all off.
Yeah. So, what you mean, yeah.
So being able to say, you know, turn off all the lights in the lounge,
mm-hmm.
to me is quite cool. But to a normal person, not so much.
I think it's there just if it's a major chore, then it's worth it, but otherwise you could just, I guess, wire them all to one switch on the wall, couldn't you?
Yeah,
that's probably
you
even
could
more
do.
Difficult, though.
Yeah, these internet-enabled plugs now are so cheap, but it's still a long way to go, right? This, you know, when a technology feels like okay, that they haven't finished making it yet. Do you know what I mean? It feels a bit like that. So for example, the front door thing, right? You know, it makes all these promises. Oh, it can detect you walking up to the door and it unlocks the door and you just push it and it opens. Yeah, sure, if you've got the right door. And if you live in America, because none of these things fit European locks. Also, we have greater security on our houses than Americans. Most Americans just have a deadlock, right? Yeah. Which is just one little lock to unlock. Ours has got like three, isn't it, up and down the door. And, you know, there are all these kinds of complications. So it sounds great on paper, but it's actually crap in practice.
It's true. I mean, can you remember when CDs came out? That was a great one. And also when digital cameras first came out, that both were made out to be considerably better quality than their analog counterparts. And, you know, how you could possibly even think of even ever putting on a vinyl record or using film or anything like that. And if you go back and look at particular... I've still got quite an old digital SLR, and it just takes crap pictures. So, yes, absolutely, we mustn't be pulled in by the, you know, the kind of advertising that goes with these new things. But
a lot of it comes down to user experience as well, actually, you know, to vaguely pull it back to the subject we're supposed to be talking about. Because it's like... Yeah, I know. But it's, you know, these things, oh, yeah, you just connect it to your door and it's fine. Well, no, you've got to
get a bloody locksmith out because your door doesn't work as it's supposed to in the pictures, you know, and then, oh, it just kind of seamlessly connects. Yeah, as long as Bluetooth doesn't get interfered with by, you know, something or other. And none of it works as flawlessly as they say it does. But I'm having fun anyway.
Okay. And I'll leave you to, basically, I was hoping you were going to persuade me that I need these things, but you haven't.
No, you don't need any of them. Absolute waste. The only one I'm quite interested in, I've always had a smart thermostat for years, and they are very good because they do things like, oh, you've gone away, so it turns the temperature down, you know? And you don't have to fit, you know, those really annoying thermostats where you're programming it. It's like programming an old VCR video recorder, you know. So getting rid of all of that is quite nice. So,
yeah.
They're quite good. I quite like them.
I should.
Anyway, none of that has got anything to do with anything we're supposed to be talking about. Should we talk about your thought for the day? What are you going to talk about today?
Well, I started talking about content audits last week, and I thought I should continue that thought. Because I said, oh, yeah, and we're doing all these extra things in our content audits, but I'm not going to tell you what they are. So I thought I ought to say what they actually are.
Yes, because content audits, if I'm honest with you, I have a pretty low opinion of them.
Yeah, and I know why, because you think that all websites should be, you know, if you're going to redesign a site, the content should be rewritten from, you know, the ground up or something like that.
No, it's not quite
like
that.
I like putting words into your mouth, Paul.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's just stick with that. Move on.
I'm not going to let you move on. It's more, it's partly that. It's part, not that it should be written from scratch, but you should start from a different premise. You shouldn't start from the premise of what we got. You know, we should start from the premise of what do we need. But the main reason, if I'm honest, is it just seems like a shit ton of work for very little return.
Yeah. Well, it depends how much you do. We're doing...
Okay, well, you tell me what you've got planned.
We're doing one at the moment for an NHS site in UK, and we're just doing effectively a kind of a pilot to get them going on it, because that's something that they'd like to review the content that they've got. So I said, well, we could just spend a fairly short amount of time, probably not even 2 days, a day and a bit, getting the ball rolling with them.
So
we started doing that. We're doing a lot more for University of Michigan, but again, we're not, you know, they've got 70,000 pages, and we're probably going to do a few hundred. So it's not crazy amounts of time on it. It's looking at reviewing important pages that would be thought of as important, or maybe good exemplars of content that, you know, people think they're good exemplars. Looking at those, so that kind of thing. Does that make sense? And certainly, I mean, with both of these sites, a lot of those pages will continue to exist. So it is worth reviewing them to say whether they should change, be edited, how much they need to be edited, that kind of thing. So I think I think there is value, but I do agree. Yeah, it's like all these things. It's one tool in the box. It's not the whole box.
Makes sense. Yes. So, and also it's not paying an outside agency to review a huge number of pages, which is very expensive, you know, because Headscape obviously charges far more than they should for the quality of work you get back. So, I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
That's so true. I mean, we must be almost up to half your rate by now.
it's return on investment, Marcus.
I couldn't agree more.
Okay. Let's stop at that point then. Yeah, go on anyway.
Detail. We've started a couple of content audits and where we're taking this kind of extended, in air quotes, approach to them. So firstly, what is a content audit? It's the process of reviewing existing content to see if, very basically, so there's more to it than this, but if you want to keep it, edit it, or chuck it out completely. You're also likely to consider whether you want to merge stuff too. I think that's a very useful aspect of it. And one of the reasons why it's good for a client to do a content audit is just for them to realise what they've got And, and to a certain extent, that's useful for us because we can learn from it. But I reckon, because I know you're going back to that kind of, you should start from what do we need. You knowing what you've got can help with that process, I think, potentially. Anyway, I've gone off on a tangent. I shall come back to it. So traditionally, in a content audit, you would look at stuff like a reviewer would read the content, look at the pictures, watch the video, whatever, and then review things like voice. So does this page fit with the voice that the institution wants it to fit with? You know, does it use active voice? Is it first or second person? That kind of thing. So very kind of technical type stuff. Then tone of voice. So is the appropriateness of tone for the intended, is the tone appropriate for the intended audience and situation? Messaging, does it reinforce one or more of the institution or organization's core messages? Then you get into things like writing style and layout of content. So, for example, does it avoid large blocks of dense text? Is there appropriate use of headings and breakouts, that kind of thing? Is it relevant to target audiences? Is there an effective use of imagery, video, or other media? And are there any relevant, clearly signposted calls to action and or related links? That's the kind of thing that you're meant to do, and we will be doing on a content audit. But added to that, we are also doing some stuff where you can kind of score pages. And the idea behind this, I mean, hopefully to bring a bit more value, but it's also to help the process of judging these pages. It's all very well, I don't know.
Yeah, because that's very subjective.
Exactly. And you look at 100 pages, and well, even if you take the kind of subjectiveness away from it, it's like, well, what is it that you might decide that all of them are okay, or that you want to keep all of these pages? Or that you see what I'm trying to say? With a qualitative review, it's harder to kind of make judgments on it. So we thought, well, let's add some scoring in. Some of this is still based on the reviewer's opinion. Some of it isn't. And they are the following 6 points, which the first one is... Well, I've missed one out. There should be 7. No, there isn't. There's 8.
See, but I can review
text and copy, but I can't count.
Yep,
so scannability is the first one, and this is something we just would be done by the reviewer, just how easy it is to scan a page. Readability, and there are loads of different ways of measuring readability. We found one that we quite like called webpagefx.com. It's one of their tools, and it gives you a score that you can... The sheet that we produce then takes whatever that score and puts it in a 1 to 5 bracket, because each one of these measurements is a 1 to 5 thing, so we can kind of pull them all together at the end. Reusability. I'm going to just quickly grab my notes on what we mean by reusability. This is something like... Hang on a minute.
I like this. This reminds me a little bit of the heuristic reviews that we do from time to time, because by turning it into numerical scores like this, I mean, I presume you'll put notes and comments as well. But
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, but by having a numerical score, it very quickly and very easily allows you to process and understand the results afterwards, because you can filter it and say, okay, which are all the pages that have got a big usability problem, etc.
You got it. Yes, exactly. You can filter. So let's say on reusability, we'd say... basically, the kind of definition for that is how much does the page need to be changed for use on the new site. So if it scores 5, there are no changes. If it scores 4, that would be just minor text changes. 3 would be text editing is required and or replacement or addition of imagery. 2 would be a significant rewrite is required, and 1 is the pages to be deleted. So you can go back in and filter that by all the pages that are worse than 3, or 3 or worse, and then just get that list, and you might decide, well, we're just going to chuck the lot, for example. I'm making this up, but that kind of thing. So effectively scoring it, nearly there. So authority, this is a Moz ranking, so Moz page authority. It's how I'm not sure how it works out. I'll have to come back on that one,
but that's nice, because you know, that's an automatically generated number.
It is.
You know, so you've got that as well. And of course, knowing your authority ranking from an SEO point of view is really good, because you want to maintain those URLs. You don't want that kind of content to break.
Exactly.
So even if my model is correct, you know, oh, you need to start from a user's need, that's actually a good justification from doing a content audit, because you don't want to break that SEO traffic, even if you end up redirecting it to a new page.
It is a composite measure combining link counts, rankings, trust, and other factors. I just couldn't find my notes. So three more to go. External visibility. This is measured by the percentage of sessions in which the page was viewed. So any session where that particular page was viewed, but where it was the landing page. So
okay.
That gives you how well it does on Google and other search engines.
Yeah,
reach is just that's just simply the number of unique page views. So
yeah.
A page that obviously has a lot of traffic will do better on a reach point of view. And finally, stickiness, which is about bounce rate. And it's pulling those factors in.
So there's quite a lot of factors there that are not a subjective, that are, you know, data-based figures, which I, you know, it's good. It's good. Okay.
That was the point of it. That was the point of trying to come up with something which isn't all subjective. It isn't all just in the reviewer. Because in theory, this is another problem. If you're going to do a content audit of, say, 1,000 pages, you might share that across 4 people. And then, even though you would try to set up definitions before you do it, people are going to measure things differently. So having these kind of score type things where you're pulling in stuff from Google Analytics and Moz and this and the readability thing just helps average that out a bit. So hopefully useful stuff.
No, that is very useful. You almost convinced me that a content audit is worth doing.
I think a small content audit is worth doing.
A small one, yes. Yeah. Although with those more automated ones, you could, you know, you can roll it out further. So, yeah, it's interesting. It's a fascinating subject. There are tools out there that help with some of this kind of stuff. Site Improve is one that springs to mind that you know, does some of these kinds of things around things like accessibility as well and other various factors. Andrew in the chat room uses Site Improve at his university that he works at. So it's a good tool. It's a good tool. Anyway. Right. Let's talk about another good tool, which is Balsamiq. Actually, I don't want to talk about Balsamiq as a tool, because by now you all will already know all that there is to know about Balsamiq. We talk about it pretty much every week. They've been a long-term sponsor. You probably had heard about Balsamiq even before you started listening to this podcast, because most people have, to be honest. But Balsamiq are doing a lot more these days than just their core tool, their wireframing tool. They're also providing a lot of learning and support stuff for people so that the wireframes they produce are better quality. And one of the things that they've done is they've asked me to create a series of initial impression videos where I look at a website for the first time and give my reaction to it. And it's all very off the cuff. It's all very spontaneous. I am not that rude. just a little bit rude. No, but I try and make it as constructive as possible. I don't rip people's websites apart because that's not very useful for anybody. But I'll say some things I like about it, some things that I feel that could be done to make it even better. And so I've done one of these already, and I have to say I absolutely loved it. It was brilliant fun. And so we've got another 4 planned. The one that I've done, I don't think has been released yet, but we're going to get a load together, and then we're going to release them all over a period of time. So I need websites to review, basically. So Balsamiq have said, ask people whether they would like their websites reviewed. Happy for it to be to review absolutely anybody's site. I've done an agency site so far, so I don't think I want to do another one of those. But if you've got any other, if you've got a very big big website, then, you know, just ask me to review a bit of it. for example, if there's a particular landing page or a checkout process or something like that, happy to review just a part of a site as well. And no, Peter, you don't need to be afraid. Peter is saying in the chat room that he needs to be afraid, very afraid. You don't. I'm very nice. I'm polite and I'm a nice person. It's only Marcus that I'm ever rude to. He has a special place in my heart, which means I can be rude to him. If you want to take part in that, just go along to balsamic.com/learn/BOAG review and submit your site there, and we'll get you done. You might be thinking on my site I'll never get picked. Well, I've said this before on the podcast about doing this thing, and we still need websites, because everybody goes, oh, my site won't be picked, nobody ever submits the site, and it's bloody ridiculous. But anyway, there you go, that's Balsamic. Right, so really good thought for the day from Marcus today. I found that really interesting, but I want to continue our conversation a little bit about conversion rate optimization. We're going to look at a couple of things this week. We're going to look at designing for maximum visibility, and then later on we're going to look at writing compelling calls to action.
Before you get going, Paul,
yeah,
I have to say your jumper looks very thick and it's making me feel hot.
It's because I'm feeling ill, Marcus.
Poorly Paul.
Look how pale I look as well, although that is the video camera that I'm using. Yeah, I'm pale and ill and drawn. Look how drawn I look. So it's very sad. Ooh. See, Michelle appreciates my jumper. She recognises good fashion sense when she sees it.
I'm not saying I don't like the jumper. I'm just saying it looks really hot. It's because it's always so boiling hot in our office.
Yeah, well, it's a very misleading jumper, actually. It actually is quite a cool jumper because I've got a T-shirt on under it as well.
Oh, okay. So it's cool in two ways, Paul, obviously.
Yeah. Right, let's talk about designing for maximum visibility. This is fairly fundamental stuff, all right? And if you're a designer, it will be very much a reminder. If you're not a designer, then it's a kind of basic stuff. But it's surprising how poor some sites are when it comes to their calls to action, how they're often hidden, right? Yes, all right, if you sit down and you look at them, they might look fine, and oh yes, there's the call to action, it's all very obvious. Yes, they might even do all right in a usability test session where the person you're testing with is giving the thing their full attention. But as we've talked about in previous shows, people rarely are giving anything their full attention. And so what might look obvious to you is not going to be obvious to users. So making sure that your calls to action are prominent and obvious is kind of conversion rate optimization 101, really. So how do we do that? Well, good starting point is think about the position of your call to action, right? Now, immediately, you're going to think, oh, it's got to be above the fold. No, right? That is not correct. People think that, oh, if it's, you know, call to action has got to be prominent, therefore it has to be high on the page. Not necessarily, right? There are two reasons for that. One is high on the page, but in the wrong position high on the page will perform worse than lower on the page in a good position. So, for example, if you put your primary call to action in the top right, right? That is dead space. People don't see top right, okay? They look at top right for very specific things like search, shopping basket, things like that. But generally speaking, that is a pretty dead space, all right? So if you put a call to action there, it's not going to get noticed. By comparison, if you put the same call to action in the central column where people are actually reading content and lower on the page, even below the fold, that will outperform something sitting in the top right, generally speaking. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of other factors involved in it, but generally speaking, that it doesn't need to be high on the page if it's positioned well. The other aspect when it comes to positioning goes back to pick your moment, which we talked about in a previous show. It's better that so let's say, for example, your call to action is sign up for a newsletter like it is on my website, right? That call to action on my website happens at the bottom of a page after an article. And the reason being is because until people have seen the quality of my content, they're not going to be ready to complete a call to action. So if I put it at the top of the page, they're going to just scroll straight past it to the blog post. And then they might forget if they're not reminded at the end. Right? So position is really important. I find that central tends to work better than left or right or anything else. In the main flow of your content is often a really good place for a call to action. But you also need to consider things that draw attention to or away from that call to action. So, for example, if I designed a page whereby there were lines of text or some kind of graphical element that kind of sloped towards your call to action, that's going to draw your attention to it. If they slope away, it's going to draw your attention away from the call to action. Now, the best example of this is imagery, right? Imagery will have an enormous effect on whether somebody spots a call to action or not. And the call to action's proximity and position related to imagery is really, really important. I often describe imagery to think of a user's attention as they look at a website, almost like a gravitational field, right? You drop something like an image into that gravitational field, and it has huge gravitational pull. So it pulls your attention to it. And so it's going to pull your attention away from other elements, like a call to action. So unless that image is in some way directly related to the call to action, or is drawing the eye then back across to the call to action, it's going to kill it dead. So for example, on the basis of what I was saying about the right-hand side is not as good as the left-hand side, you might think, oh, I'll just drop an image into the right-hand side and have the call to action to the left of it. Well, yes, except that gravitational pull of an image is so heavy that your eyes could well skip directly over the call to action to the image and never make it back there. Unless there is something in the image that pulls the eye back to the call to action. And that might be a line or a movement in the image or something like that. The best example, the most powerful type of images is faces, right? So faces are incredibly powerful. We're biologically programmed to look at faces. So if you have, take that example I just gave. You had a call to action in the left and an image in the right. If that person's in that image, that face in the right-hand column, if that person is looking back towards the call to action, you're rosy because you'll follow their eye movement back to the call to action, right? Yeah, Marcus is demonstrating this perfectly on the video camera.
I've been doing
useless.
It for the last 5 minutes, Paul.
I don't pay any attention to what you're doing. But if Marcus looks off to the right-hand side of the page, as he's doing at the moment, your eye gets drawn off the page and that's it. You lose them. Even if he's looking directly at the camera, because the call to action is to the left, your eye's going to jump over the call to action, look at Marcus, and that's like a full stop. He's looking directly at the camera, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the use of imagery is really, really important. And where people's eye lines are, or, you know, what the direction of movement, any of those things is really important. So we use imagery, but use it with care and closely associate your calls to action with it. Another thing that works very well if you want to draw people's attention, talking about gravitational fields again, right, is to remove anything that has a gravitational field from around the call to action, right? So even if the call to action itself isn't that bold, it's not that strong a gravitational field, if there's nothing around it sucking attention away, then the call to action stands out. So in other words, include a lot of negative space around your call to action, right? Because then nothing else is going to pull your eye away from it. Another thing that you can do, which is kind of fairly obvious but is worth saying, is make your call to action big. Right. Although we all joke about make my logo bigger, When it comes to your call to action, size is important, right? Size does make a difference. And it doesn't just make a difference because obviously the bigger it is, the more attention grabbing it is. It also makes a difference because it allows you to do more things with your call to action, right? So take an e-commerce site, right? You might have a buy now button on an e-commerce site. If your buy now button is relatively small, all you've got space on that button to say is buy now, right? There's no more space to say anything more. So yes, you'd put text around it and that kind of thing. But the problem is people read things out of context. They don't always read everything that's around it. You double the size of that call to action button. Now you can have something like buy now to become a better gamer if you're selling, I don't know, gaming mice. Okay? So you can put more context in the call to action, which means that it's going to perform better. All right? So size really does matter. We can also use color, of course, contrasting the color with the things that are around it works really well. But again, beware of the fact that a large number of people are colorblind, right? So you can't rely on color alone, but it certainly, you know, can make something pop if it contrasts with the colors, the main color palette of your website. But then obviously, if you have lots of different colors going on your website, it's not going to make any difference. Now, there's an interesting side note to this color thing, which is social media icons, right? Mm-hmm. One of the many, many reasons I despise social media icons on websites with such a deep passion is because their color scheme doesn't match the rest of the website. So it makes them stand out from everything else that's going on. Now, that's fine if your primary call to action is the social media, follow us on social media. But in other situations, well, most situations, it's not, is it? That's a secondary thing.
We just use the words Instagram and Twitter. Just the words with a little.
Yeah, fine, great, cool, lovely.
It? Or you could grey them out, I suppose. I'm never sure whether you're allowed to do that. I bet you are with Facebook and Twitter.
You do whatever the hell you want. It's not like Facebook are going to chase down every person that changes their colour of their logo, is it?
No, because they would have to have a company the size of Facebook to do that.
Yes, but most of them are too busy trying to extract advertising revenue and mining your personal data to be bothered about anything else, aren't they, really? So, colour. And then to use colour, but be very careful. You make sure you're only, as like, for example, whenever I create a colour palette for a website, I always have what I call a highlight colour. And that colour I only use for calls to action. The other area you need to be a bit careful in, but is really powerful, is animation. Without a doubt, we're programmed to notice movement. So anything that moves grabs our attention. So obviously, if you use that well on a call to action, that can grab your attention, right? But be so, so careful here. Do not have looping animation, right? Because looping animation becomes, unless it's got a very, very long loop, but looping animation continuing, because animation is so powerful and movement is so good at grabbing our attention, too much movement distracts us and makes us unable to concentrate on other things. Like, for example, the sales copy that's trying to encourage you to complete the call to action. But I've seen some really nice stuff done where, for example, you scroll down on a mobile device. There's one I really like where it's got, you scroll down the page and there's the add to basket button, right? Next to the product, right? And as you keep scrolling, once the add to basket button hits the bottom of the screen, instead of it just scrolling out of sight, it tethers to the bottom of the screen, so it's there continually, you know. And that's a nice little subtle animation, or something fades in when you first scroll past it. Those kinds of things are fine. So yeah, that's all I really wanted to say about visibility. I mean, fairly basic stuff, but I think it's quite important that we kind of cover the basics on the show sometimes too. And it's so easy to forget this kind of thing as well. You know, when you're actually designing, to remember all of this stuff, you know, that especially around things like imagery and how imagery affects other items. Because when you're in a design, you can get so kind of caught up in the minutiae and the details that you don't take a step back and look, oh crap, that image is going to have a big consequence on the items that are around it. So yeah, there you go.
I've been trying to get people to that sounds like what I was about to say. It sounds like every client, once in a while I try and get people to kind of, if it's, start again, Marcus. If a site's purpose is kind of, the call to action is quite singular, there's one thing, there's one purpose to the site, then often go back to kind of the Google example of, well, go and look at how Google is designed. It's just like a simple call to action in the middle of a screen, right? There's a few bits and bobs darted around. But I've never managed to persuade anyone to go that simple. But what you're saying there kind of does support all of that.
It does, but you have to consider the sell, the journey that the user is on, right? So with what makes Google unique is that they have one, certainly from their search point of view, they have one very simple task that needs no persuasion. You don't need to persuade people of anything. They go to Google to search on something. So as a result, then they can go that minimalistic, you know, they just need a search box. But if there's any kind of journey involved, if there's anything before that, then it's necessary to persuade people of that, to provide supporting arguments to that.
Yeah.
So it's a tricky one. But yeah, absolutely. Strip out everything. We were talking about this morning in the Slack channel because I'm working on a checkout process at the moment. And I've designed this checkout process and I keep looking at it and going, there's nothing in it. it looks empty, you know.
But as I was saying, going back to the, even in a usability test, somebody is focused on the task, therefore they will see stuff. They're more likely to see stuff than if they're just randomly arriving somewhere. So it's even more reason to make it really simple.
Yeah.
And get rid of all the distractions. So, yeah.
But it's really hard to resist that urge to go, I need to add more to it. You know, almost not only, I can understand clients wanting to do it because they're trying to persuade people, aren't they? So you add more and more. But as a designer, you know, there's a part of you that's going, well, they're paying me to design this and I'm not really putting anything in it, you know?
Yeah, anyway. Well, I agree that is good design.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So let's talk a bit about Full Story. I don't want to talk about something that I've not really talked about with Full Story. So Full Story is a session recorder, right? So it allows you to watch sessions back. It allows you to understand what users are doing on your site and stuff like that. But there are other tools like that out there. And we very much focused on, you know, why do you want a session recorder and, you know, how do they work and what, you know, what benefits they provide. But we haven't talked so much about why Full Story in particular is good and why it's my favorite one of the session recorders out there. And I think the thing that really makes me lean towards Full Story rather its competitors is it is so fast and intuitive to use. It really is incredibly simple. So it's got this thing called OmniSearch, which helps you find basically anything you want, right? So you can find particular customers or people that are rage clicking, or you can, you know, summon up page analytics or build funnels and all of this kind of stuff just by starting typing. You know, it's one of those really straightforward experiences where you can just type in whatever you want, and it's just so, you could type in your problem rather than working out what options you've got to select and that kind of thing, which I absolutely love. You can also move fluidly between kind of aggregated data and individual sessions. So you can go, for example, and say, you know, looking at the aggregated data of all the things that people rage click on, right? And then you could go, oh, well, show me examples of people that rage click on this particular thing. And it pulls back all the videos for it. And then you might watch some of those videos and then go, you know, watch one in particular that goes, oh, that person is also doing this particular thing. And then you can say, well, give me aggregated data on everybody that's done that particular thing, right? So it's like, it's, I think I described it once like Wikipedia, that you could just go from one thing, you get drawn deeper and deeper into all these different things. And it's even really easy to set up as well, because you basically put one piece of JavaScript on the website and it's going to record every user action. Right? So there's no maintenance, there's no manual tagging of specific things you want. It's all just there. So it's so, so intuitive. So it's definitely worth giving a go. You can sign up for a free month of their pro account. No need to enter a credit card. Even they even make that easy. And then you can basically use it for a month, give it a go. If you get to the end of the month and you can't maybe justify continuing with them, you can get 1,000 sessions per month for free. If you do want to sign up, then you enter your credit card and away you go. So to sign up, go to fullstory.com/BOAG. Include the BOAG, because otherwise I don't get credit. And obviously, you know, it's nice for them to know whether their ad, the money that they're spending, actually goes anywhere. So, yes, there we go. Let's talk about writing compelling calls to action. So we've talked about some design stuff. Let's talk about some writing stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay. First of all, put credibility before hype.
Yes.
I know. Yeah. But it's so you say yes, right? Okay. But didn't we talk about this before on the show?
Yeah, I suppose it depends. It depends, doesn't it, on how much you want to keep your customers?
Yeah. But no, there's an honesty example. Did I tell the thing about? Yeah, I'm sure we had the conversation about bacteria and killing. You know, these things, the antibacterial things, and you know, and it said, well, you know, how honest is honest? How much is credibility before hype? Because do you have to say, no, you're not allowed to write 99% of all germs dead. You should say fails to kill 1% of all germs. You know, so it's not a black and white thing, right? What I think is about, you know, not hyping stuff up would be different to what you think, Marcus. But of course, neither of our opinions matter. All that matters is what users think.
Yeah.
So be very careful. If you're going to write things like headlines and calls to action, please, please pass it by a real user, because you might not think you are hyping things up, but your users might think something different. So, and it's a really tricky balance to get right, because you want to put, of course you want to present your products in a positive light, and you should do, but it's very easy to kind of stumble into the world of hype and bullshit, basically, and marketing bullshit.
Would your, the title of your new book come under that, maybe, about being a dick? Or is that, it's not really hype, is it? It's just sort of like whether it's appropriate. It's a different
thing. Well, we're not going to really call it that. It won't make it. I know it won't. And probably rightly so, to be honest. It's funny for about 30 seconds if you've got an immature sense of humour like you and me. Mm. But it's probably not the right way to go in the end. But yeah, and again, you've got to take your audience into account as well.
Yeah.
You know, fine if my book was just appealing to, 20-something male web designers that have, obviously all men have the sense of humour of a 9-year-old boy. But, you know, I want it to appeal to people beyond that demographic, probably. Yeah, so put credibility before hype. That said, I think we can write attention-grabbing headlines, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with writing those kinds of headlines. So headlines that ask you a question, right, are really good, because we instinctively answer a question, right? You know, would you like to become a better gamer? Going back to the gaming mouse example I gave earlier, right?
No.
Marcus wouldn't want to become a better gamer, but you wouldn't be falling into the demographic that is buying a gaming mouse, would you? So, you know, questions like that, but it forces you to answer it. Mm. And so to some level, you're instantly engaging. Other types of engaging headlines would be the list, 10 ways to become a better gamer. Now, lists have got a lot of bad press over the years. People have said they're lazy writing and stuff like that if you go for lists. But the actual truth is they're lazy reading, right? Mm. That's why people like lists. That's why lists are effective, is because you can just scan them and get the gist of it, right? So I'm actually a fan of lists. I think, you know, lists have got a lot to be said. You know, 10 reasons to sign up to our newsletter. Great. And then the third approach that you can use has completely gone out of my head. Oh, how-tos, of course. How to become a better gamer. Obvious.
Right. Obvious.
So, it was so obvious, yeah.
It wasn't obvious.
So obvious that I'd completely forgotten. So, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, those will make your headline, you know, your headlines more compelling. And then also the wording that we use in them. Although we want to emphasize credibility over hype, that doesn't mean we can't use some powerful and engaging words, right? So, you know, a lot of words have got real emotion and real power to them. So you can talk about, you know, you could talk about signing up for a newsletter, but using something like now or today is more compelling. It's, you know, sign up today, you know, it encourages action.
You won't believe what comes out in the third newsletter and things like that.
No, see, and that is hype. Yes, it is a hard line to get, and it, you know, but yeah. So actually, there's quite a good tool that I use for this sometimes, which is a tool produced by CoSchedule. So if you Google CoSchedule headline optimizer, it will bring you up a tool. Now, like any automated tool, I ignore it on a regular basis.
yeah.
But it's quite useful to kind of get you thinking about the words and terminology you use, whether they're emotional, you know, whether they're powerful, etc. It's also got a great list of those kinds of words that you can refer to. But don't, you know, use your judgment on it.
I use it sometimes. The other thing,
yeah, it's just good. Yeah, it's worth a look. The other thing you need to be looking at is focusing on benefits and features together, right?
Okay. Yep.
So instead of, you know, buy our gaming mouse, become a better gamer is more compelling because it focuses on the benefit that you're eventually going to get from that rather than I'm going to get a gaming mouse. Do you see what I mean? You're joining the dots in people's minds as to why they want this particular thing.
And I agree with what you were saying there about, you know, features as well, or function as well. So it's like, yeah, become a better gamer by using our, you know, super duper mouse that's got these extra three buttons on it or whatever.
Yes.
All of that, I think, is people want that information.
They do want that, and it can go horribly wrong if you don't provide that as well. The best example I ever saw is I went to the Skype homepage near Valentine's, right? And the big banner at the top of the Skype homepage said, connect with loved ones this Valentine's, right? That was it.
Okay. Right?
So if you didn't know what Skype was, it could have been a dating site, right? It could have been a social network. Yeah. It could have been anything. Right?
Yeah.
But, you know, and so that's no good, is it? I tell you who does it well, or sometimes, I remember one example where they did it well, which was Apple, right? Apple do this great thing. They had this great line, I think it was either for the iPad or the MacBook. And it said something like, I can't remember the exact wording, with a 16-hour battery life, it will keep going as long as you do, right? And that's quite nice because it gave you the feature,
yep,
right? 16-hour battery life, but then the benefit of why that matters.
Yeah.
And that's what you're trying to do, is get that balance between the two. And marketers tend to lean towards benefits and UX designers lean towards features, but you need both. The two work together. But that then makes the next recommendation hard, which is be concise. But There has to be a caveat on that. Be concise, but favour clarity. Right? So you read something like Steve Krug's book, Don't Make Me Think. And he's got a whole chapter dedicated to admitting needless words. And it's very easy to read that chapter and go away. Oh, you've got to have as few words as possible. Right? Yeah, you actually have to have as few words as possible to succeed in communicating the message that you need to communicate. Conciseness shouldn't come at the cost of clarity. It shouldn't mean that you don't get to say what needs to be said.
Yeah, there's a point, isn't there, when something gets so simplified that it starts to become difficult to understand.
Yeah,
then you've gone
or it
too
doesn't
far.
Cover all, it doesn't say all the things it needs to say
yeah.
in order to convince people, right? But, you see, the problem often comes is, let's say I wanted to convince Marcus of something, right? That actually the Festa look that I'm currently, you know, carrying is the next best thing, right? Is where
no,
things
no
are
need,
gonna...
No need to persuade me of that.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's imagine that you didn't think that my
sorry,
haggard,
yes.
pale look was the way to go in the future. So I would then have to persuade Marcus of that. Now, I would make my arguments, but what often happens is we then start rewording that in a slightly different way, right? In our desire to convince.
I'm dreadful
well, maybe,
at that, yeah.
Yeah, maybe if I said it this way, it would get through.
Mm.
And you get that in copy a lot. Right? So people will make a point and then make the point again in a different way. Now, that is verbose copy.
Yeah.
Right? It's also verbose copy if you try and be kind of, well, happy talk is what Steve Krug talks about, which doesn't really add anything. It's not communicating anything. So be concise, yes, but not at the cost of clarity.
Agree.
And with your copy, the main thing, actually, your copy should do most of the time is something called objection handling, right? That's what good salespeople do, right? You know, they ask people, so what's stopping you ordering this used car today, right? And then they will systematically knock down each objection you bring up to the point where you haven't got a reason not to buy.
Best salespeople of all do that before the objections even come up.
Yes, exactly. Spot on.
Yeah.
So as a result, that's what our copy should be doing. It should be dealing with objections before they come up, right? So, let's think about something like signing up for a newsletter. Signing up for a newsletter, right? What are the objections people come up with? I don't want to be spammed. Right? It might not be relevant to me. They're going to make it hard to unsubscribe. You know, they'll sell my data to third parties. That kind of thing. Well, if you look at the copy on the BOAG World site where I try and persuade people to sign up to my newsletter, I systematically deal with each of them. So the copy reads, every 2 weeks, so you know how much I'm not going to spam you every day, you know, you're going to get it every 2 weeks. You will receive support improving your site by creating a better user experience and more effective digital strategy. So that tells you whether or not it's relevant to you. You can unsubscribe in one click, and I'll never share your email address with anyone. You see what I'm getting at?
Mm, totally.
So that's objection handling. And then the final thing is think about the structure of your calls to action, your headlines as well. So you need to think about this with blog posts as well, their titles of blog posts. People tend to scan headlines, right? So they'll read the first three words and the last three words of the headline. And that should give them
That's
the gist of it.
I didn't know that.
So again, people won't necessarily read the whole thing. They just read bits of it. So they'd be read the start of it and the end bit of it. So if you can take the start of your headline and the end of your headline and kind of stick them together and it still vaguely makes sense, then you're in a good place as well. So there's
going,
a few
going
random...
Going to your site now, Paul, and reading out your headlines.
Oh, I'm not saying all mine do it. It's do as I say and not as I do. Right?
Well,
so here we go.
This is a brilliant one. My complete guide for your company. There you go.
Yeah.
Doesn't say what about. Yeah, yes, it does. That does kind of work on certainly
but
on longer ones.
Yeah, I eat my own dog food, which I never understood that stage. That's a very weird phrase.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's about it for this time. Just to say that a lot of what we've talked about today, I've written quite a long, comprehensive guide. Because I seem determined to make you not buy my own masterclass, which the whole of the flipping season was supposed to be about. Yeah, anyway, rant over. If you go to boagworld.com/design/cool-2-action, then you'll get a complete guide to all of this kind of, basically everything we talked about today. So no need to buy my masterclass at boagworld.com/masterclass. Marcus, mm-hmm. You do a joke.
I will. These are all Paul Edwards ones because he sent me loads or put loads in the Bowerville Slack channel. Again, sorry, a bit UK focused, but I'll explain it afterwards. A Tale of Two Cities was first serialized in two local newspapers. It was the Bicester Times and the Worcester Times. Or the Worcester Times. Said it wrong.
You messed it up.
I messed it up. The Bicester Times and the Worcester Times.
Also, Bicester?
Yeah.
Is that a place?
Yeah. In Oxfordshire. Oh. Bicester. Bicester.
Never heard of it.
And the best so, times. I've ruined the joke completely. It's a very good joke, but not
the Worcester. Well. Worcester Times. Yeah, that works.
So does the
Bicester.
Time.
I'd not heard of.
Oh, right, yeah.
They're places, in case you hadn't worked
that
out.
Yes.
That was a very UK-centric joke. It made Kat in the chat room laugh. Well, she could be the crying
laughing
emoji.
At the delivery, probably.
Yeah, I think that's probably what was going on there.
But yeah,
everybody else in the chat room completely silent. Yeah. Not
tumbleweed.
Tumbleweed. Anyway, thank you very much for listening to this week's show. We'll be back again next week. Goodbye. Bye.